From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, just what President Clinton needs, two more critiques of his inaugural address. We call political satirist Harry Shearer and Fresh Air's resident linguist Jeff Nunberg. What faces our new president in Iraq? We'll ask Jeffrey Kemp of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. British singer-songwriter Elvis Costello is up to something new. The former angry young man of rock is now collaborating with a string quartet. He'll tell us about his new musical turn. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Body of Evidence, the new movie starring Madonna and Willem Dafoe. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. In just 14 minutes today, President Bill Clinton tried to convey his vision for the United States in an inaugural speech that emphasized the themes of sacrifice and service to America. He paid tribute to George Bush for his half-century of public service, but then enumerated the social ills that, during the campaign, he'd blamed on the Bush and Reagan administrations.
But when most people are working harder for less, when others cannot work at all, when the cost of health care devastates families and threatens to bankrupt our enterprises, great and small, when the fear of crime robs law-abiding citizens of their freedom, and when millions of poor children cannot even imagine the lives we are calling them to lead, we have not made change our friend.
The new president referred to change 9 times in his speech, and he said it was now time for his generation to take power and assume the responsibilities that go along with it. The inaugural address was followed by a poem composed by author Maya Angelou. The poem, called On the Pulse of Morning, spoke of the common themes of human experience and hope for the future.
Here, on the pulse of this new day, you may have the grace to look up and out and into your sister's eyes, and into your brother's face, your country, and say simply, very simply, with hope, good morning.
Angelou is a professor of American Studies at Wake Forest University in North Carolina. The Environmental Protection Agency has ordered U.S. companies to phase out one of the world's most popular pesticides. The order to stop producing or importing methyl bromide was one of the final actions taken by outgoing EPA Administrator William Riley. NPR's John Nielsen has more.
Farmers all over the world use methyl bromide gas to kill the fungus that grows on crops like strawberries, alfalfa, and wheat. Unfortunately, as methyl bromide breaks down and rises through the atmosphere, it thins the Earth's protective ozone layer. Under the revised Clean Air Act, gases that deplete the ozone layer must be phased out by the year 2000. Agricultural groups fought hard to postpone this EPA order, partly on grounds that no effective substitutes had been developed. American strawberry farmers said a decision to ban methyl bromide would reduce the size of their crops, which would raise prices. Environmental groups, who sued to force the EPA decision, said those complaints were overblown. In Washington, I'm John Nielsen.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 14 points to close at 3,242. Declines edged advances in heavy trading of 268 million shares. This is NPR. Michigan Dr. Jack Kevorkian assisted in another suicide today, the 9th in his campaign to win legal acceptance for physicians helping terminally ill patients to take their own lives. Kevorkian's attorney, Jeffrey Feiger, said that the retired pathologist helped bone cancer patient Jack Miller commit suicide by inhaling carbon monoxide through a mask. A Michigan law that would temporarily ban physician-assisted suicides is set to take effect in about 2 months. A United Nations envoy has returned to Israel to try to find a solution to the expulsion of more than 400 Palestinians to South Lebanon. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
Special envoy Chinmaya Gera Khan today held talks with Foreign Minister Shimon Peres and Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. It is his second visit in a week and seems to be a last-ditch effort to solve the problem of the exiled Palestinians. Gera Khan came with a warning.
Well, the Security Council, I think, is feeling already quite impatient on this matter, and I'm not prepared at this moment to give any definite deadline. But the fact of the matter is that the council feels that this matter has been delayed already enough.
Foreign Minister Peres asked the envoy to convince the United Nations to delay further action against Israel until the Israeli Supreme Court rules on the legality of the expulsions. That ruling is expected within the next few days. Tomorrow, Ambassador Garakhan holds another meeting with the Prime Minister to try to convince Israel to allow the exiles to return. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
A new storm rode into the Pacific Northwest today, carrying heavy snow and rains on winds of up to 100 miles an hour. And the storm closed highways and tore out power lines, darkening the windows of almost 200,000 customers. And the power outage extended to the Washington State House, where state government was shut down. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
My fellow citizens, today we celebrate the mystery of American renewal. This ceremony is held in the depth of winter, but by the words we speak and the faces we show the world, we force the spring.
With those words, Bill Clinton began his first speech as the 42nd President of the United States. We watched, we listened, looking for insights into our new president and the directions he will lead us in. Harry Shearer watched, looking for clues about the man he will be satirizing for the next 4 years. Shearer's political satire is heard regularly on All Things Considered and his own national radio program, Le Show. He's also a former cast member of Saturday Night Live and does many of the voices on The Simpsons. We called Harry Shearer to find out what he thought of President Clinton's inaugural address.
Well, first of all, I'd say that as the first member of the baby boom generation to take this high office, I was a little surprised at Bill Clinton allowing the Marine Band to play the Monty Python theme.
Yes.
Before the oath.
That's right.
I thought that was sort of a slipped stitch there because while George Bush could have been excused for not knowing the association, there's no excuse for Bill Clinton not getting it.
That's right. I forget the name of what the march is actually called.
But we all know it as the Monty Python theme.
Exactly.
And I was sitting here with a friend, and we were both saying that this sets up a very dangerous expectation of a giant gorilla's foot coming down on the whole ceremony.
Good point. What about the writing of the speech?
Well, you know, I think that the speech was written with a very functional attitude. That is to say, Bill Clinton, we know, is capable of writing and enjoying giving a very long speech. So I think left to his own devices, he might have done that, except it seemed to me like the speech was written so it would be short enough that he couldn't lose his voice during the speech itself. It seemed when he rose to those certain high moments that he was really like checking to make sure the voice was going to be there when he reached the high point of it. The actual writing, you know, I think this will go down as a serviceable one. Basically, its insistence on a meteorological oddity, forcing the spring, is about the only thing that you sort of remember from it.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. Do you think that works?
Well, it had a certain meaningfulness, and yet, you know, all I saw really was sort of cold fronts going across the upper Midwest when he said it, so.
any other lines that will stand out in your mind, you know, that you will remember?
Well, if I will, I'm not remembering them now. So they'll have to be brought back by repeated viewings on videotape later.
What was going through your mind when you were watching the now First Family during the inauguration? Were you reading any thoughts into their heads?
Well, you know, it's I was watching this avowed Elvis fan watching Marilyn Horn doing a hyper distinguished performance, thinking, and I'm wondering if he's sort of measuring himself against the cultural élan of the Kennedys at these moments, and going, well, this is what Kennedy would have listened to. This is what Jackie would have made Jack do at the inauguration. So I'll have some of this.
Did you start wondering who chose Marilyn Horn?
Well, he did.
He did? Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Were you wondering what Bush was thinking as he was leaving Washington?
Well, you know, I heard him listening to the speech, and you ungrateful little draft dodger, that kind of, as he was, you know, as he kept hearing references to drift. Hey, drift this. That was all I could think that he was thinking. And I thought there was a wonderful euphemism that somebody used on television to describe the burden being lifted from Barbara Bush's shoulders, that she was going to have a lot more of George to herself. Because, of course, there have been all these rumors about the affair with at least one major Washington figure in the State Department. And I thought, well, that's the most elegant possible way of putting an end to that, by getting your husband diselected.
Do you have memories of other inaugurals? Have you been watching them over the years?
The one I have most clear memory of is the 1980 inaugural, partly because it was that weird release of the hostages going on at the exact same moment, and you know, that started people wondering for years and years and years until the House, of course, removed all doubt earlier in October. And the other reason I remember it is because I had an adult case of the chicken pox and was trying to find a comfortable position to place my head in to watch Reagan swear in.
It must have been horrible.
Yes, it was, but you know, I got over it, and so did the country.
Have you been trying to get down Clinton's voice?
Yes. Yeah, I've done him a few times, and obviously now the, you know, they talk about the pressure on him, but really, Terry.
The pressure's on you, I know.
Much more on me, because all he has to do is be himself.
Whereas you have to be him.
Well, I have to be him. He's not trying to be me.
Gee, you know.
Yeah.
What a valuable perception.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, so what are you going to do to try to be him?
Well, I try like going out in very cold and windy weather and just yelling at the top of my lungs to get that sandpaper quality. You know, that thing right there, that thing that's we're going to get very used to very soon.
Well, Harry, I look forward to hearing more of your political satire, and thanks a lot for talking with us today.
Thanks, Terry. My pleasure.
Harry Shearer's political satire can be heard on All Things Considered and his own program, Le Show, which is carried on many public radio stations around the country. Fresh Air linguist Jeff Nunberg listened to the inaugural address. He's the usage editor of the American Heritage Dictionary. We asked him to share his impressions of the president's speech.
Well, I had the impression of somebody writing an abstract of an inaugural address. Maybe that's why it was so short. I mean, he sits there with all the text of all the previous inaugural addresses and kind of writes an abstract with summaries and allusions to the things that other inaugurals have said. Little Kennedy, a little Roosevelt, a little King, and then he's out.
What are some of the images that struck you as summaries of standard themes?
Well, there was a little bit. There was, of course, this renewal business, which is a standard theme, and then there was a little bit of Roosevelt. But where Roosevelt had said, "How did it go? I see one third of a country ill housed, ill fed, ill clothed." Clinton had, when most people are working harder for less, when others cannot work at all, or when the cost of health care threatens our families and threatens to bankrupt our enterprises, great and small. There was a little Kennedy, I challenge a new generation of Americans to a season of service, offer more opportunity to all and demand more responsibility from all, with a pretty clear allusion to ask not what you can do for your country. But all put in a more prosy way, which maybe wasn't bad. Maybe that's the way an inaugural address should be nowadays. Maybe Clinton's finally got television.
Well, in the sense of like being more casual,
less formal, briefer at last.
Yeah, I think the departure from that informality was that last image about. From this joyful mountaintop of celebration, we hear a call to service in the valley. We have heard the trumpets.
Right. There was a lot of King in that. And in fact, the way he said that, from this joyful mountaintop of celebration, he stressed joyful in a way that really recalled King's voice, not just King's words. And that was the allusion to King, yeah, absolutely.
Is there any part of the speech that struck you as particularly informal for a presidential inauguration address?
Well, there was one point at which he was talking about politics, and he was talking about the Capitol. He said, powerful people worry endlessly about who is in and who is out, who is up and who is down. It was a very, so probably the most strikingly informal line that's ever appeared in an inaugural address.
Do you think that's a good thing or an okay thing?
Well, I don't know if he intended it to be so informal, but I don't think it's a bad thing. I mean, he really wasn't speaking to, for all his invocation to posterity, I had the sense he really wasn't speaking to posterity, but speaking to present-day Americans. Even the attempts to produce memorable history-making lines were kind of summary and not particularly strong. So there were about 3 points at which I saw him going for the memorable quote for the history books. This is our time. Let us embrace it. And there's nothing wrong with America that cannot be cured by what is right with America. And we must do what America does best, offer more opportunity to all and demand more responsibility from all. But in all those three cases, they were kind of summary efforts almost at producing a memorable quote. There wasn't really any attempt at that ringing eloquence that what we used to expect from an inaugural address.
What do you think of Maya Angelou's poem?
I thought she was trying to do everything that Clinton wasn't, trying to speak to history and so on. I mean, there were a couple of things that were striking. One is that in the entire poem, she never used the word America. There was just this long list of the Hispanic, the Asian, the Jew, the African, the Native American, the Sioux, the Rabbi, the gay, the straight, the privileged, and so on. You had the sense that she was aiming for at creating the poem that would be the obligatory epigraph in every multicultural Basil reading series from now on.
Did you get the feeling that that list was supposed to end with, and the white guy?
And the white guy, yeah.
So the poem didn't work for you?
No, the poem didn't work for me. There was one point when she said that she talked about something about the mastodon and the dinosaur who left dry tokens of their sojourn here on our planet floor. And my mind was racing, but I don't think she had in mind what I did.
What did you have in mind?
I'm sure she just meant the bones. Not the mastodon droppings on the rock and the river and the tree. I don't know.
How important do you think inaugural speeches are? What do they mean to people?
I don't know. You know, the way the press talks about them, it's always as well, this is your one shot to get a line in the history books. But I don't know if students have to memorize inaugural addresses anymore in school. So I'm not sure. It is this one occasion for a conspicuously formal address to the American people and this one occasion in which presidents measure themselves against posterity as orators. I think people have a sense of that, although I'm not sure that it really has much of an effect on the way people actually go on to perceive the administration.
Did the young Jeff Nunberg have to memorize presidential inaugural speeches?
Oh, yeah, with malice, with charity toward none, with malice toward none, with charity toward whatever. However, yeah, I had to memorize Lincoln's second inaugural, and of course, Kennedy's inaugural, I imagine students a little younger than me had to memorize. So, sure, along with Patrick Henry and all of that stuff.
Well, I'll let you get back until you get that whole speech right.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks for talking with us.
Bye-bye, Terry.
Jeff Nunberg is Fresh Air's linguist. He's associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto. Coming up, what faces our new president in Iraq? This is Fresh Air. One of President Bush's last acts in office was to bomb Iraq, to forcefully make the point that Iraq must comply with UN resolutions. Iraq has declared a ceasefire in what it described as a goodwill gesture to President Clinton. For some insights into what awaits President Clinton, we call Jeffrey Kemp of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, D.C. He's the author of The Control of the Middle East Arms Race. He served in the Reagan administration as the National Security Council's Director for the Near East and South Asia. I asked him what he thought motivated Saddam Hussein to declare a ceasefire.
I think he wants to send a signal to the Arab world, to the UN, to the Europeans, to Bill Clinton, that really his quarrel was with George Bush, not with the United States and the rest of the world, that George Bush is gone, therefore let's have a clean start and see whether we can work out some deal. I think that's his wish. I think it is, quite bluntly, wishful thinking to think Clinton will buy onto it.
In the recent interview that Clinton gave with the New York Times, he said he wasn't obsessed with Saddam Hussein and that he would judge Saddam Hussein on his behavior. It's been pointed out that Saddam Hussein's, quote, good behavior can be just another tactic to get us, to get the United States to behave the way that Saddam Hussein wants us to. How would you recommend that Clinton judge Saddam Hussein's behavior?
Well, my bet is that once Clinton starts the daily, in fact, sometimes three or four times a day, briefings on foreign policy, which he'll be getting as of tomorrow, my guess is he soon, too, will become obsessed with this man, because so long as Saddam Hussein is in power, it's very difficult to orchestrate a coherent and meaningful American strategy for the Middle East. In particular, it's difficult to see how we can come to grips with perhaps a more serious, longer-term challenge, which is the growth of Iran and the possibility that Iran will be formulating and fermenting unrest throughout the Middle East in the months and years to come. So while I think Clinton initially wanted to draw a distinction between Bush's behavior towards Saddam and how he would respond, increasingly I think he's going to have to adopt much the same policies. And if Saddam lives up to his usual billing, he too will get under Bill Clinton's craw, and Clinton will have to deal with him in much the same sort of way.
So you think there's going to be a period in which Clinton tests Saddam Hussein and Saddam Hussein tests President Clinton?
Yes, in a sense, because I doubt very much whether Clinton is anxious to unleash the United States Air Force and Navy tomorrow, particularly since the strikes that Bush conducted last week have been getting some flack from countries such as Russia and France, key allies who are necessary to hold this coalition together. On the other hand, I don't think Clinton can wait indefinitely, because while Saddam may say he's offering an olive branch, and while the headlines may not report violations of UN Security Council resolutions, it has to be remembered that one of the most sinister things that is going on in Iraq right now is Saddam Hussein's systematic undermining of the security and welfare of the Kurdish population in the north, which we are vowed to protect. Saddam has been interfering with UN relief operations, has been sabotaging those operations. There have been incidences of terrorism perpetrated by Saddam's personnel against the Kurds. This will continue. It will continue as the winter gets harsher and harsher, and Clinton will get daily briefings on this. So at some point, you know, I would suggest in weeks rather than months, Clinton's going to have to make some tough statement on Iraq. Hopefully he will do so after he's lined up some international support and got to know some of the foreign leaders that he's going to have to deal with. Like it or not, that day is coming.
There has been the question, and even some of our allies have raised the question, of whether the force that we used was proportionate to Iraq's transgressions. How do you measure that?
You can't, quite frankly. My feeling is that Iraq's transgressions are so enormous, particularly if you take into account everything that has been disclosed since the end of the war concerning the atrocities against the Kurds, that short of literally occupying or using Iraq or using weapons of mass destruction, there's virtually nothing we could do that would be proportionate to the tragedies that Saddam Hussein has inflicted on his people and the neighborhood. That said, I do think there is a very serious problem in the context of proportionality and even-handedness when it comes to comparing our actions in the Middle East as distinct from our non-actions in Bosnia-Herzegovina. And here, I think, quite frankly, the Arabs, indeed the Muslim world, has a point when they say you do nothing to enforce the UN no-fly zones in former Yugoslavia, but you bomb Saddam at a whim. But I think you'll find that most countries in the Middle East, while disturbed about the the recent use of force against Iraq. Privately, if you ask the leaders of the Arab world in private, wish Saddam Hussein were killed. They wish they would love to see him overthrown. What they do not want to see left behind is chaos in Iraq. They would like to see a regime other than Saddam Hussein's in control, a regime we could work with, a regime that in the last resort could become a check to the growing power of Iran, which I alluded to earlier.
But that regime would have to be run by someone other than Saddam Hussein?
That is correct, yes. Yes.
Are there contenders in Iraq for that position?
Well, there are obviously generals and colonels lurking around Saddam's corridors who clearly would take over if Saddam were assassinated. Whether they would be any better for us or not is a matter of dispute. I somewhat doubt it. The Iraqi exiles, the types who we would probably like to see take power, are located, you know, in the north, in the Kurdish area, in London, all over the place. And unfortunately, they don't present as united and coordinated a front as we would like, and therefore it's difficult to single out individuals who one could designate as successors to Saddam Hussein. One option Clinton has, incidentally, is to make much more of an Iraqi government in exile and to work within the framework of the United Nations to formally de-recognize Saddam as the leader of Iraq. This would be difficult. It'll take a lot of agility and persuasion on the part of the new UN ambassador, Madeleine Albright, but it's certainly a new tactic that Clinton might want to follow.
Would you recommend to Clinton covert action in Iraq, covert assassination of Saddam Hussein, covert attempts to overthrow Saddam Hussein?
Well, of course, there are laws about this, and the first thing that would have to happen is we'd have to change the law that forbids assassination. If the law were changed, certainly it is one option to think of. But short of that, there's dozens of things we can do. We can infiltrate, we can stir up trouble in the north and the south, we can help mess up his economy through sabotage and the planting of phony counterfeit money in Iraq. If we put the assets into this, there's a lot more we could do. And now that the Soviet Union no longer exists, and we have this vast intelligence service that still sits out there, you know, in Langley, Virginia, it may well be that Clinton wants to, you know, use Mr. Woolsey and his assets to work on the Saddam problem as much as he wants to use General Powell and the United States military establishment.
From what you know of President Clinton's choices for Secretary of State Warren Christopher and Secretary of Defense Les Aspin, what directions do you think they will be taking American foreign policy in the Middle East in?
I think it will be, particularly in the case of the Middle East, almost identical to Bush. If anything, I could see them being a little tougher. I think in Aspin, in Woolsey, in Tony Lake, who will be the National Security Advisor, and in some of the people in the State Department, including, I think, at this point, Warren Christopher, there is no appetite whatsoever for appeasing Saddam Hussein, making any concessions to Saddam Hussein. If anything, this group are going to be more pro-Israeli than the Bush administration. In short, I would say that if Saddam Hussein thinks he's going to have a honeymoon, it will be a very short-lived one.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay.
Jeffrey Kemp is a senior associate with the Carnegie Institute for International Peace in Washington, D.C. Our interview was recorded earlier today. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, a new musical direction for Elvis Costello. In the 70s, he was at the forefront of rock's new wave. He's since written songs in just about every pop genre. Now he's collaborating with a string quartet. We'll talk with Elvis Costello about writing words and music with the Brodsky Quartet. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Body of Evidence, the new movie starring Madonna, Willem Dafoe, and Joe Mantegna. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Thousands of people stood in cold, sunny weather today as President Bill Clinton took the oath of office, while millions of people around the world watched on television. In a speech lasting less than 20 minutes, Clinton said that there is nothing wrong with America that cannot be cured by what is right with America. During his speech, Clinton called for sacrifice, service, and change, and said the country would be ready to protect its vital interest with diplomacy or force if necessary. Barry Schwide reports.
The speech was short, and there was little in it to suggest the foreign policy the new president will pursue. There were some hints, a preference for diplomacy over force, a Jeffersonian desire to have the U.S. serve as a model to other nations, a sensitivity to the instability the disintegration of the Soviet Union has left in its wake, and there was no singling out of Iraq or any other target of U.S. displeasure. If the new president has a new approach for dealing with them and with tough problems around the globe, it will become evident on another day. Iraq's ceasefire call and Bosnian Serbs' acceptance of a truce could give him some breathing room. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
Less than 3 hours after Bill Clinton was sworn into office, the Senate convened to start confirming his cabinet nominees. First to be confirmed was former Senator Lloyd Bentsen as Secretary of the Treasury. Next, former Chairman of the House Armed Services Committee Les Aspin was confirmed as Secretary of Defense, and then Warren Christopher as Secretary of State. Before leaving office today, George Bush signed a resolution cutting the pay of the new Treasury Secretary because Bentsen was in the Senate when it voted to raise the salary for top government officials. Russian President Boris Yeltsin is among the many heads of state who have sent messages of congratulations to President Bill Clinton, taking the chance to stress Moscow's hope of maintaining close relations with the new Democratic administration. NPR's Kathleen Hunt reports from Moscow.
President Yeltsin told reporters in the Kremlin today that he sent President Clinton a telegram congratulating him on his inauguration. In the message, he underscored the need to maintain the momentum in relations between the two countries while the United States makes its transition from a Republican administration, which many Russians regard as their greatest ally during the demise of the Soviet Union. The president of the Russian Federation also said that he would be meeting with the U.S. president in the near future, possibly in a neutral country. Despite mounting criticism from Russian nationalists and communists for his pro-Western policies, Yeltsin's been eager to avoid a lapse in bilateral talks with the U.S., with hopes of carrying out crucial disarmament treaties and easing Russia's deepening economic crisis. This is Kathleen Hunt in Moscow.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 14 points in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. In Bosnia, a self-styled Serbian parliament gave its support today to a UN-sponsored peace plan. Under this plan, Bosnia would be divided into 10 provinces, mainly along ethnic lines. Only last week, members of the European Community had given Serbian factions less than 1 week to agree to the plan. And UN officials say that peace talks will resume in Geneva this Saturday. Over the last several days, Muslim and Croatian factions have turned on each other in apparent bids to gain more territory before lines are officially drawn. President Bush's adopted hometown became his permanent residence today. The Bush family arrived in Houston this afternoon, where they were welcomed by hundreds of supporters. Mr. Bush said his family will be good private citizens and neighbors. Mike Rosen of member station KUHF reports.
What formerly was Air Force One touched down at Ellington Air Force Base around 3 o'clock this afternoon local time. The former first family was greeted by supporters carrying signs and banners and American flags. The initial cheers were for Millie, who walked off the plane first. Mr. Bush told the crowd he's looking forward to private life.
I think it was a lovely inauguration. I had a chance to wish our new president well. And now it's back to the real world for the Bushes.
The Bushes are renting a house from a friend until their permanent residence is built. When asked what he and Barbara Bush are doing tonight, he said they're going to go home and have some supper. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Rosen in Houston.
Alabama Governor Guy Hunt has pleaded not guilty to 13 felony charges in connection with allegations that he and three associates conspired to move $200,000 from a tax-exempt inauguration fund to Hunt's campaign fund. The Republican governor has called the indictment a political attack directed by a Democratic state attorney general. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Elvis Costello used to have the image as the angry young man of rock. In the late 70s, he was at the forefront of rock's new wave. Since then, he's become one of rock's most respected songwriters, and he's written in just about every pop genre. His new record takes a surprising turn. It's a collaboration with a string ensemble, the Brodsky Quartet. They're best known for their interpretations of Schubert, Beethoven, and Bartok, as well as new music. All the songs on the new album, The Juliet Letters, are written in the form of letters. This one is called For Other Eyes.
I don't know what I would do if this letter should fall into other hands than it should pass through. For other eyes.
How did you and the quartet arrive on a theme for the record and a style of working together collaboratively?
We got around the piano, they played pieces of music, and we just talked about the characteristics of music and how they appeal to us. The things about songs which you heard echoes of them in pieces of music that they couldn't possibly have influenced one another, but something about them had this intangible quality. All the sort of things that maybe you sit around talking about with people who really, really love music. And that way we sort of developed an unspoken language or an unspoken series of idioms from which we could draw and write our own compositions. And then by sheer chance, my wife happened to see this article in a newspaper, this little novelty item, really, about this professor in Verona who had taken it on himself to answer letters addressed to Juliet Capulet. Now, how he got hold of them, I don't know. You know, they're in the dead letter office in Verona for 6 or so years. And, you know, these people are writing to a dead imaginary woman, so...
You
know,
really, yeah.
You know, but people write to characters in soap operas. They don't write to the actors, they write to the characters. People write to Sherlock Holmes, you know, they write to Santa Claus, you know. They might have been serious letters. We didn't go into it, we didn't research it, but... It started us thinking about the idea of the letter form.
Let me play one of the songs that I particularly like. This is called Letter from Juliet. But first let me ask you about writing it.
The song I thought I'd write to Juliet?
Yeah.
Well, that was one that actually, curiously enough, came quite early on. It sounds like one that it was almost as if we did the most difficult thing first. We did one that had lots of separate parts to it. It almost is a letter within a letter. And yet it was one that we composed and wrote the text of very early on in the scheme of things, as I recall. From the lyrical point of view, it's related very strongly to a letter that I actually received myself. I received this letter from a soldier who was in the first Gulf War, as we'll probably now have to call it. And it was a very sad letter, but I'm you know, saying that I'm very afraid and I don't know how I got myself into the army and here I find myself in this ditch and, the only thing I've got is some records and my gas mask and pictures of people at home. And it was very pathetic, really. But nonetheless, my initial reaction maybe was not that sympathetic. And it took me to look at it a few times before I saw the human, before I saw past the title of... a member of what I would think of as an army that was not necessarily fighting a noble cause. And I talked about it with the quartet, and we tried to find some way of setting it in a way that we could explain the presence of this letter. So I invented a character, I suppose similar to my initial response, somebody who's very cynical. And he begins the song by describing how he's received this letter, and he's mocking it, really, and telling another friend of his who he's writing to about receiving it and his sort of cynical response to it. But then he simply quotes it. And when from the time that the original soldier's letter is quoted, the music changes quite a great deal. And I think you come to realize that there is something to have sympathy with or to have pity for in the context, in the text of the letter.
It's actually a beautiful letter. Is this the letter that you received, or did you rewrite
it?
It's
close to it. It's close to it, and I hope the person that sent it, you know, haven't used their name or anything so that they needn't feel in any embarrassment as such.
The letter that's quoted is from a woman in the military station.
That's right, yes. That was the particularly unusual thing about it, I suppose, that it made it, doubly so. Some, you know, particularly somebody who got in and done a career, you know, and the letter talked about joining the army to raise funds to go to college and being all the things you're taught to be very positive and self-assertive and everything, and then finding yourself in a predicament that maybe the implications of which you perhaps don't fully understand. You're a professional soldier, you don't necessarily understand the complexities and deceits of modern global politics.
Well, why don't we hear I Thought I'd Write to Juliet from Elvis Costello's new album, The Juliet Letters. This is Elvis Costello with the Brodsky Quartet.
I thought I'd write to Juliet, for she would understand. And when someone is already dead, they can no longer let you down. Instead, I find myself talking to you as my oldest friend. Tell me how I can advise someone that I don't even know to welcome death. For I received a letter that is worth reporting. And though it may raise a cynical smile, it leaves a sinking feeling, like when a soldier in a story says to the sergeant, "Have you seen my pride and joy? You know the rest, and it's no joke. Forgive me, please, as I quote." This is a letter of thanks, as I'm so bored here and I can't say where. So I'm writing to people that I may never meet. And I was thinking of something you said. I am a female soldier. My name is Constance. I enlisted in the military, needing funds for college. I'm 23 years old, and if I do get home alive, I imagine I may think again. I'm sleeping with my eyes open, fear of attack. Your words are comfort, they're the best things that I have. Apart from family pictures and of course my gas mask, I don't know why I am writing to you.
The writer in your song who gets this letter says, "How can I tell someone I don't even know to welcome death?" Is that the reaction you had when you got this very kind of difficult letter.
One of the immediate responses is, how can you tell somebody just not to be afraid?
This is someone you didn't even know, someone who just knew you through your songs.
Yeah. I mean, I never did actually write back, you know. What do you say in those circumstances? I don't reply to every letter that I receive unsolicited. Sometimes it's just as well, because you're dealing with people who are obviously unhappy and have projected that unhappiness into something they've heard in what you have said or written or sung. And they are not always, seeing it clearly.
Elvis Costello is my guest. He has a new album called The Juliet Letters, featuring his collaborations with the Brodsky Quartet. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Elvis Costello is my guest. Do you think that this project, with songs about specific letters on specific subjects, has changed your songwriting in any way? And I'm talking about the lyrics here. You know, a lot of your lyrics have been very elliptical to many of us over the years. Do you think that that's changed at all on this record?
I should maybe explain how we actually started. You know, we made a list of letters, and then one night we all went home and wrote suicide notes, which, you know, as an exercise, I mean, I hasten to add. And then everybody came
right.
in. It wasn't because we were working together or anything, you know. And we came in the next day and read them out, and it was very awkward. It was a little bit like being back in school. But once we'd done that, of course, the fear was out of that process, and people were bringing in things. Every time we met, everybody was arriving with words and music. And you should understand that though the quartet are engaged in playing music all the time, only Michael Thomas, the first violin, actually composes on a regular basis. And I don't think any of them had written words before. But I think that's the whole strength of it, is that they wrote from a very unprejudiced, unbiased way. They didn't have any crafty sort of ways of phrasing things which were typical to them. They simply sat down and tried to write letters.
So the lyrics for Dear Sweet Filthy World come from the suicide notes that you'd written when you started working together?
Yes. Yes, I mean, it was one of the first things. I mean, we may have amended them slightly, you know, as we went along. But, we got on the process of writing these things very quickly once we decided that the letter form was the way, and once we got over our natural inhibitions of showing each other barely finished or barely formed work.
Why don't we listen to the song that you've been describing that's a compilation of the suicide notes? This is Dear Sweet Filthy World.
Dear sweet filthy world, my wife, all I think that I've lived too long with all of my promises unfulfilled. But there is a veil drawn over all of that.
That these songs bring out different qualities in your voice than when you're singing rock and roll?
Oh, definitely. I mean, obviously, I'm not competing with the same amount of volume, with the same conflict of frequencies. I mean, rock and roll thrives on a collision of frequencies. The bass is doing something at variance to the left hand of the piano, and the cymbals are clashing quite literally with the electric guitars, and it's all a big exciting mess, and somewhere in the middle of that somebody's shouting their head off a lot of the time. I mean, there are quieter moments as well, of course, you know. With this, everything is very, very clear, I think, and therefore the voice can operate in a lower register without failing to project and be heard.
You didn't write or read music before this project, but you've started to learn. You never needed to read or write. I mean, after all, you're a songwriter.
Not really for the songwriting very much. When I worked in film a little bit, it became more frustrating, I suppose. And I did I co-wrote a score for a television series called GBH the year before last, And it was a very, very exciting experience. I wrote a lot of themes, and my partner wrote a lot of themes, and he did all of the orchestrations, and some of them carried on from sort of suggestions and directions that I gave, and others were completely transformed. And I thought, well, this is wonderful. It's been a wonderful experience, but I've done this now, and I think if I were to ever work in film again, I should know how to write it down so I can get my ideas exactly across. So I had already resolved to learn how to go through this barrier of feeling that I didn't need the notated form. And now, of course, I have the luxury of both.
Do you feel that the angry young rocker image is behind you, or do people still associate you with that?
It's sort of like angry old rocker now. I don't know. It depends on what, you know, in some ways it's sort of, if it's just a limitation, then I think it's kind of, in some people's minds, it might still be there. And, of course, they will maybe say, well, you're not what you were. Well, of course, you know, that would be crazy. But I think there are some of the same. I still feel at sympathy with a lot of the things I did and said when I started out. I don't feel like I have anything to be ashamed of, so it doesn't really bother me. It only bothers me when I feel it's becoming a trap.
And when did that start to happen? When did you start to feel it was?
Well, it doesn't become a trap in my mind. It's a trap in other people's minds, mainly. You know, mm-hmm. they won't let you escape a certain time that they have you pegged to, or a certain set of attitudes that they associate you with. And I think a piece of work like this, you know, just shows that you needn't be like that. And what we're asking the audience to do is come along and listen. You know, and the quartet, of course, are taking an equal risk. You have to understand that. I mean. I think I'm probably taking less of a risk to sort of reputation or whatever that is, because I've never been that much concerned about that. But I suppose in a world that is so governed by critical acclaim as the classical area is, for them to be seen to be dabbling in the pop world could be damaging if people didn't realize that it was a wholehearted and passionate collaboration and it wasn't some sort of silly crossover thing thought up by a record company.
Right, I guess that would enter into a lot of people's
minds. Yeah, I think the first thing.
It raises
horrible spectres of hideous things from the early 70s with rock groups. And,
you know, right, with the London Symphony Orchestra.
Rock groups on ice and, you know, with choirs. And equally, I have to say, I think some of the most hideous things are coming in the other direction, you know, inappropriate choices of material for divas to try and sing like Peggy Lee. I mean, I can't see the point, you know.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Elvis Costello's new album with the Brodsky Quartet is called The Juliet Letters. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, we have a new president. What do you have on President Clinton's day?
We are going to analyze the speech, play excerpts from it, compare and contrast, Terry, as well as play some substantial excerpts from the poem that Maya Angelou read on the occasion of the inaugural, and we're covering the parade and the people who are watching it. But the part I'm really looking forward to is hearing from four of our commentators who are here especially to talk about this inaugural day. Andre Codrescu is in town, as is Bailey White, and of course Verda Mae Grosvenor and Bob Garfield are already from here, so we're waiting to hear what they have to say.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Madonna may be one of the most successful entertainers in the world, but she's never quite achieved stardom in the movies. In fact, two of her pictures, Shanghai Surprise and Who's That Girl, were out-and-out flops. Will her new movie reverse her fortunes? Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Body of Evidence.
You can admire Madonna's energy and her boldness and her ability to keep her finger on the public pulse, but let's not pretend she's ever been an original. Almost everything in Madonna's catalog of pop imagery has been borrowed, from Marilyn Monroe, for instance, or Marlene Dietrich, or the movie Metropolis. Grad students grinding out their Madonna in Modern Culture theses like to call what she does postmodernism, and that certainly sounds better than theft. In fact, you could probably argue that the sort of, well, appropriating that Madonna does has helped make rock videos passably interesting. But in movies, this stuff won't wash. Body of Evidence is dying to be a courtroom thriller in the vein of Witness for the Prosecution or Anatomy of a Murder. It's also dying to be a femme fatale picture like Body Heat, Gilda, and about a million others. But this movie makes Basic Instinct look like Citizen Kane. How bad is it? so bad that its very premise is a howler. Get this. Madonna plays a lubricious gallery owner with a yen for wealthy older men, especially wealthy older men with heart conditions. Her latest conquest has just died after a night of torrid, handcuffed lovemaking. And now the prosecutor, played by Joe Mantegna, wants to convict her of first-degree murder. He thinks she gave the victim cocaine and then copulated so madly with him that she knew he'd have a heart attack, whereupon she'd get the $8 million he's left her in his will. Enter her lawyer, Frank, played by Willem Dafoe. He's happily married, but not so happily that he doesn't let Madonna lure him into playing S&M sex games with him. In fact, the two of them are having a pretty hot time until evidence emerges in the courtroom that Dafoe didn't know anything about. Now he's mad, and Madonna says to him,
"You think I killed Andrew?"
"So does everyone in the courtroom."
"You are not on trial."
"Oh, the hell I'm not. I must have been out of my mind to get involved with you."
"To make love to me?"
"Yes. But I'm not going to compound my mistakes. You're my client. That's it. I don't want to have anything to do with you beyond that."
"Just like that?"
"Yeah.
Like I don't have any feelings."
"Hey, I'm not your type. I'm too young and healthy."
"That's not fair, Frank."
"No, but it's accurate."
It's bad enough that Willem Dafoe delivers all his lines as though he had a mouthful of ice cubes. It's bad enough that the sex scenes are so strenuous and unerotic that they look like outtakes from the Mistress Cleopatra workout video. I don't know which is funnier, the sight of Willem Dafoe trying to look aroused while scrambling around on a car hood strewn with broken glass, or this movie's avalanche of courtroom cliches. Every time the camera closes in on the schoolmarmish judge, you can be sure she's about to say, "I don't want to have to warn you again, counselor." But the worst thing about Body of Evidence, of course, is herself. With her shaved eyebrows and lined, puffy face, Madonna has never looked worse, even though the screenplay insists on telling us every 5 minutes or so how beautiful she is. And her acting remains an embarrassment. She can leer and she can snarl, but she can't deliver dialogue. Every line sounds like an effort. All in all, Body of Evidence should turn out to be yet another great career move for Sharon Stone.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein and Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Penny Nelson. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, America's most popular out-of-the-closet lesbian comic, Kate Clinton, host of the Gay and Lesbian Inaugural Ball. Also, we talk with punk music star and monologist Henry Rollins about the murder of his best friend. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.